Myanmar joined ASEAN in 1997. Many analysts expect Tan Shui to wield power after the election in some other capacity, for example as president, an unelected position. Philippine and Indonesian diplomats at the summit have condemned Myanmar's election as a farce. Other governments, such as Thailand's, have expressed optimism that while less than democratic, the elections could create more space for Burmese opposition parties. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Bangkok.
Halloween lanterns, recently picked up at Dollar Tree stores, may turn out to be scarier than they look. The Consumer Product Safety Commission is recalling more than 680,000 of the battery-operated lanterns because they might overheat and catch fire. Consumers are advised to go back to the store where they purchased the recalled items for a full refund. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
Stephen Sondheim has a new book collecting his lyrics and telling the stories behind them. On the next Fresh Air, Sondheim tells us some of those stories and offers some surprising criticisms of other lyricists, including his mentor, Oscar Hammerstein. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580. Now that our on-air drive is over, WILL would like to say a big thank you to the more than 1,000 listeners who contributed over $171,000 in membership support. Your generous contributions truly make a difference.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is our producer. Kyle Mabry is at the controls. The British Secret Intelligence Service, popularly known as MI6, is the oldest continuously surviving foreign intelligence gathering organization in the world, and certainly it is one of the most famous. It was founded in 1909, and it grew, says our guest this morning, historian Keith Jeffrey, from rather modest beginnings to the point early in the Cold War when it had become a permanent branch of the British state. Our guest is the first person, certainly the first historian ever, to be given access to the MI6 archives, and he has used what he learned at spending time with that over a period of years to write a recently published book that is recently published here in the United States. That's titled The Secret History of MI6. It is published by the Penguin Press, and it deals with the period from 1909, when it was first founded, up until 1949. There are some reasons why it doesn't go any further than that, and we can't talk about things that happened after 1949. We'll talk about that a little bit with our guest, Keith Jeffrey. He is a professor of British history at Queen's University, Belfast, and has written or edited 13 books, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. We just hope people will be on the topic and try to keep their questions brief. We'll try to get in as many callers as we can. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that one, 800-222-9455. We do have email, so if you'd like to send a question that way, you can write us at will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, certainly questions are welcome. And Professor Jeffrey, hello.
Hi. It's good to talk to you.
Well, thanks very much for giving us some of your time. I think it's a fascinating story, and I'm sure that it does fascinate people because they're fascinated with stories of espionage. And I'm sure that we will, and you cannot possibly avoid talking about James Bond anytime that MI6 comes up, because that was the agency for which he worked.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very high brand recognition. I mean, here's an agency which the proper name of it is the Secret Intelligence Service.
Mm-hmm.
But no one really heard of the Secret Intelligence Service. Perhaps it's secret. Everyone's heard of MI6, and everyone's heard of James Bond. And it's a kind of benefit as well as a problem it's a benefit because of this brand recognition. I mean, people would kill or die for kind of that kind of brand recognition. On the other hand, they carry myths with them, which may lead to, you know, different expectations at times.
Yeah. Well, and certainly it's the kind of thing that has been enshrouded in mystery. And it is also the case that, and do correct me if I'm wrong about this, but it was not until 1994 that the British government actually officially admitted that MI6 existed.
Yes, I mean, it is astonishing that it was sort of 80 years on. If you'd asked a British government official, as happened quite frequently, you know, tell me about MI6 or SIS or whatever, they would have to say, I can neither confirm nor deny that this agency exists, which is completely absurd because the dogs in the street knew about it. But it was a kind of fiction which suited them at the time, so they wouldn't have to do anything. Now, the modern world doesn't really allow that kind of thing. And the taxpayers, apart from anything else, are paying for this organization. So I think they deserve a bit of information, too. And it's on a much safer basis now than it was in those far-off days, it seems.
Well, the reason this book exists at all is that a former head of the agency, Sir John Scarlett, commissioned it, and apparently it was his feeling that the agency would actually benefit from being a bit better known, or at least he there was some appeal of setting the record straight on some things.
Well, absolutely. I mean, also the centenary of the organization is a very powerful motivator. I mean, any institution that survives 100 years actually begins to think about its history a bit, you know, if it's a golf club or a school or anything like this. And MI6 is no different. But also, over the past sort of 10 or 15 years, it has come out of the shadows. There is a sort of accountability mechanism. There's an Intelligence Services Committee in Parliament. So there is kind of scrutiny. Now, they've got a website, you know, for goodness sake. And so there is a case for explaining or being a bit more open about their past and their activities. And he was a historian himself, I think, at university, so took a particularly close interest in this. But the big sort of opportunity he gave me is as an independent historian. I am at work in a university. I have a reputation to defend. Is to leave it to me to make my calls about the analysis of the organisation with a sort of free run at it. So they took a kind of risk in that, I suppose. But that's the proper way to do it. I mean, I would obviously say that myself, of course.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that here in the United States, in some of the parallel agencies, I think that perhaps, particularly since the end of the Cold War, there was this feeling that they, having been previously so secret, like the NSA, that everybody said, oh, you know, officially it didn't exist, but of course everybody knew that it did. That there, I think, was this desire to be a little bit better known as a way of, in fact, justifying their existence to the people who were, in fact, as you say, paying the bills.
Yeah. I mean, wasn't it no such agency?
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
That kind of thing. Well, exactly the same thing in Britain. These are very expensive organizations, and they are important organizations. I mean, no grown-up country actually does without an intelligence agency of some sort these days, and that's one of the differences from 1909 to 2009, if you like. But I think in a democracy, it's absolutely essential that there's some kind of accountability and explanations which the taxpayer might well deserve to have. Yeah.
Now, it would be natural that you might be asked to do this since your area of research and interest is military diplomatic history. That's your brief, but I wonder if, as an historian, you had at any point any second thoughts in this respect. That is, some people might say, "Well, how, is he really giving us the straight story? Are they giving him the straight story? How did you go about trying to at least think about think about that?"
Oh no, absolutely. I mean, this is not. I mean, in one sense, it was an easy decision because the archives of this organization are the holy grail of British archives. No document is released from the organization to the National Archives. You know, it's screwed tight shut. It's exempt from all kinds of freedom of information legislation. So when someone comes and says to you, you know, there's a chance that you might have privileged access to this archive that no other historian ever has, I mean, that's enormously tempting. I mean, it's taking up the high mountain and all this can be yours. Now, of course, the downside to that is it's not how you want to work. I want to make my name as a historian in a free and open kind of competition, if that's what it is. It isn't necessarily that. You know, that people can check my sources and check my references and validate what I say. And there is a source, also a kind of suspicion that the skeptics will say the very fact that I get the job makes me the least suitable person to do it. Mm. So there's a kind of Faustian pact here. On the other hand, if that's all that's an offer, I'm prepared to run with this and take the risk because this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. No one else is going to get the chance. There's no plans for anyone else being let go at it. So there's this one book, and you get one go at it. And, well, there was a selection process, and I wasn't the only person considered. But having got the job, then I'm going to run with this one. And in the end, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, or in this case, the reading. And it's really up to the readers to decide whether or not I'm some hack, tame, eviscerated spokesman for the agency, or I remain, what I hope I do remain, an independent, critically attentive historian.
And just real quickly, and I have a caller, I promise I won't make this person wait too much longer, but why stop at 1949?
Well, what the organization does is so sensitive that they felt they couldn't let me have free rein to tell the story. I mean, it might have let me look at the documents, but revealing what they have becomes progressively more difficult the closer you come to the present day. And what happens in the late 40s is you begin to get these long-term Cold War operations, which run for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years on till the end of the Cold War, and that makes it very difficult. I mean, what this organization does, as any foreign intelligence gathering organization in any country does, is it breaks laws. It breaks other people's laws. So it's already, you know, highly sensitive. It's not like, you know, domestic security, where they shouldn't break domestic laws. So the kinds of activities of it are just so sensitive to revelation. That they decided that was as far as they could let me go. Now, I fell on my knees every night and thanked the Lord I was only going to 49 because there's 800 pages in this book. It's already a gallon in a pint pot, and I'd have had to leave stuff out if I was going further. But you know, someone will tell the story after 49 someday, I hope.
Our guest, Keith Jeffrey, is professor of British history at Queen's University Belfast and is author of a book that has recently been published here in the United States, The Secret History of MI6, that is Britain's intelligence agency, and the one that deals with foreign intelligence, not to be confused with MI5, which is the one that's sort of a parallel agency that does domestic intelligence gathering, which got its own history book. So maybe the folks at MI6 decided we should have one too.
Exactly.
And it's published here in the U.S. by Penguin Press. Questions welcome. And we do have someone here, so they've been patient, and we'll get to them. Others are welcome too, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here is our caller, line one, Champaign. Hello.
Oh, hi.
Yes.
Yes. I haven't had a chance to read your book yet, but I have read the reviews, and I did have one question. Do you have a chapter in there dealing with British covert operations during World War I over here in the United States to get the United States to enter World War I on behalf of Britain, despite the fact that the American people and Congress overwhelmingly did not want to go to war, and ultimately killed 60,000 American troops for absolutely nothing, and wounded, destroyed, harmed hundreds of thousands of them. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a really good question. And the answer to it is, yeah, well, it's not a whole chapter, but certainly it does cover some of British covert operations in the First World War. It's very important for the British to try, and in both World Wars, to try and draw, make sure that the neutral United States are aligned at the side, at least as a benign neutrality, at the very least, if not active allies in the war. Now, the course of issue of the war and the results of the war is a separate issue. You know, whether it's justified or not is, in a way, not part of my job to decide that. And there are huge debates among historians today as to whether, you know, the world would be a safer place if the First World War hadn't been fought, and if, you know, Prussian militarism survived, you know, to dominate Europe or whatever it happens to be. And that's a kind of separate issue. But it is certainly the case that one of the things that MI6 has done in the 20th century is to run kind of covert propaganda operations, yes, in neutral states, including the United States. And there is coverage of that, yes, in the book.
Well, do you want to amplify on that just a little bit more? What exactly they did?
Okay. Well, I mean, what the regular diplomats are doing anyway is trying to, you know, win friends and influence people. And that's what they do all the time. And as were the Germans. One of the actual principal issues which the British had was the supplies of war munitions from the United States, of which there's a lot, and which, you know, is absolutely essential for the British war effort. At the same time, there are German spies and agents working in the United States to sabotage the supply of munitions to Britain. So the British then set up operations in a kind of cooperation with the New York police, among others, to stop that. They work on, schmoozing up to journalists and opinion formers of one sort or another. There's a very important individual, a man called William Wiseman, who is the head of the British operation in North America, who is greatly admired, impresses Colonel House, whom you will recall is President Wilson's most trusted confidant and a very close advisor. And House perceives in Wiseman, and Wiseman causes him to believe this, and it turns out to be true, that he could provide direct channels through to Downing Street for the president. At the time, there's a change of government in Britain, President Wilson's a bit anxious to get hold of Lloyd George. Wiseman turns up, and he says, actually, I can do this, persuades House, and he has unparalleled access to the White House. He goes on a golfing holiday with the president. He and House draft a policy document which the president signs. Now, this is a foreign agent. This is, you know, a foreign national with that kind of access and influence, which is very, very important. And it is part of the process through which the United States does go to war eventually in 1917.
All right. Well, let's talk with another caller. This is someone in Urbana, and it's line number 2. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Jeffrey.
Hi.
Two very different questions for you. One, has the Secret Intelligence Service actually brought down foreign governments, such as the way the CIA brought down the Mohammad Mazadegh government in Iran?
In Iran, yeah.
And the other question is, was the late author of spy novels, Clive Eggleton, ever in the Secret Intelligence Service?
Well, the second one I can answer because I don't know. I haven't come across him under that name or whatever other name, of course, he may have had. So I can't confirm or deny it because I don't know, and it's not. I'm not sort of evading that, you know, in some way. As for bringing down foreign governments, no. There is a point in the 1930s where they helped stymie a projected communist revolution in Brazil. So that's not sort of bringing down it, that's stopping it. The sort of direct action kind of thing is much more characteristic of the Cold War era, I think. I was saying to the previous questioner about bringing influence in other governments. Now, they certainly do that with liaison services. But direct action against governments, I can't think of any example during the period. They're beginning to do things right in the 1940s. They have these sort of operations to penetrate Sovblok and the Soviet bloc, rather, after the Iron Curtain goes up. And there's a series of operations which they're running in parallel and in cooperation with the Americans in 49 into Albania, which is to support, as they understand it, opposition groups within communist Albania. Now, these go very, very badly wrong, and it flows into the period after my book finishes. But there are certainly attempts at that late stage to try and encourage nationalist opposition groups within the Soviet Union, but they don't really come to anything, I'm afraid, and they're, in fact, very costly of men's lives.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, you know, one of the things that I'm sure that people ask about and that we have Ian Fleming to thank for it is the License to Kill.
Yeah.
You apparently actually made a very deliberate effort in looking through the material that you had access to see if you could find any evidence of targeted assassinations of foreign leaders or individuals, and that you came away without anything.
No, I mean, it was something I came to and thinking that, actually, if there aren't any of these kind of operations, people aren't going to believe it. If this isn't sort of bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are more fatalities in the first 2 minutes of any James Bond movie, as it turns out, than almost the entire history of the service. I mean, of a targeted, directed type. Primarily what the organization does for this first 40 years, or at least for most of that period, is information gathering. I mean, they are intelligence gathering. They begin to dabble in special operations, which is the kind of thing that involves sabotage and assassination and dirty tricks kind of thing. At the beginning of the Second World War, the late 1930s, when the then chief, a man called Sinclair, begins to say, oh, I think perhaps we want some kind of expertise for sabotage, subversion actions. And they set up a branch of the organization, which is hived off in 1940 and turned into a thing called SOE, Special Operations Executive, who are very similar to some of the things the OSS do during the war. And at the end of the Second World War, SOE gets drawn back into SIS, and they do some special ops things in the late 40s. But there are a couple of examples of people being killed in the Second World War, both of whom are traitors and are blabbing to the enemy. This is wartime, after all. There's a very interesting case just before D-Day in 44, where someone comes up with an idea to have a systematic assassination campaign against German kind of military transport officers, I mean, working the infrastructure in occupied France. And if they manage to shoot, 50 of these at once, it'll paralyze the reinforcements against the invaders. And they discuss this, and I cover this in some detail. And someone says they're not against killing Germans at all. There are plenty of Germans they'd like to kill. That's not the issue. But the issue is, will it work? Is it efficient? Will it make a difference? Really the answer comes back is that if political assassination actually worked that well, people would do a lot more of it. Secondly, when you do these kinds of assassinations, you're going to make mistakes. You have to take that on board. Thirdly, there'll be reprisals. And the Germans were really rather good at reprisals, as we know from a couple of terribly tragic incidents. And another argument which struck me as a very sophisticated kind of view is that these are quasi-civilian people. You know, they're working or running the railways and the rest of the things. And we are going to win the war, sooner or later. We will have officers in the same kind of position occupying Germany, in a year or two. And they will, in their turn, become targets for this kind of assassination campaign. And these are the kinds of discussions that you don't see in the James Bond movies. It's sort of wheel in, cut out the cancer, shoot the baddies, and the white hats win and the black hats don't. License to Kill turns out to be a license that's, free fire kind of zone. And it's very rarely thought about in any kind of sophisticated level.
All right, let's talk with another Urbana listener here, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have some questions, and I certainly don't have the historical perspective that you have. I'm Irish born and my family were immigrants here, and they used to talk about black and tans in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's the whole thing, you know, just currently going on historically. Yep. Since then. And, of course, with the Easter Uprising and all that other good stuff. Can you tell me, does your book touch on those issues?
Ah, the Irish angle. No, I'm Irish myself. I work in Belfast. I was born in Belfast. I was quite keen to give as much Irish stuff as possible. Now, the difference, of course, the thing about this organization, it's foreign intelligence from foreign sources. And for most of the 20th century, Ireland is regarded as domestic and not foreign.
That's true.
And so, in fact, the Irish angle tends more, in fact, to the United States. In the First World War and at the time of the Easter Rising, one of the things that MI6's organization, it's not very big at this stage, but in the United States, one of the things they do is to chase after Irish Republican sympathizers in North America and do that. Which is, again, this external role. There's very little role concerning Ireland itself. There's a moment in 1937 when the government decides that they do need some information about the new De Valera's new sort of separatist, sort of mildly Republican. It isn't. They don't declare a republic, but they're more nationalist than before. Government in Dublin, and they ask MI5, whose job it should be, because they do, you know, as it were, security stuff within the empire, which Ireland is still technically part of. And five say it's too difficult and we don't have any staff. So they pass it over to MI6, who do set up a kind of operation which doesn't really work very well. And by the time the Second World War comes along, then MI5 take over liaison with Irish intelligence, which is very close. And so that's really as my period. Now, as for the more recent period, it's not something I can really talk about in any detail. But insofar as there are foreign dimensions to the Irish struggle, the troubles that are going on, then MI6 has a legitimate interest in that. Whether it's North America, whether it's Libya, whether it's, you know, supplies of Semtex explosive from Czechoslovakia, as it was in the Soviet bloc then. But that's a case for, you know, a future volume.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate
okay.
your
all right, thank you. That's, I guess, again, it just the people should understand here that early on, really almost from the start, the intelligence there had these two branches, that one that was primarily to deal with domestic threats and one with, or to work domestically, the other to work internationally. The one is MI5, the other is MI6. So as you say, Ireland would have been considered to be the home
yep.
front, and that, if anything, that should be the territory of MI5, not 6.
Yeah, and it's the FBI, CIA, I suppose, is the closest parallel in the United States.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of focus is Keith Jeffrey. He is professor of British history at Queen's University, Belfast, and is author of the book, The Secret History of MI6, Britain's spy agency, sort of, as he said, sort of their equivalent of the CIA. It covers the period between 1909 and 1949, and it is published by the Penguin Press, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You also can email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think it's interesting, you go back to the origins of MI6. This was founded in 1909, and while we think of these agencies like MI6 and also CIA as being very much about the Cold War, back then, as far as the British were concerned, they weren't worried about Russia. They were worried about Germany.
No, indeed. Before the First World War, Russia is an ally, and it's an ally against Germany with France. The British and the French and the Russians were quite close at that stage. And the big worry for the British was that on a global sort of level, suddenly Germany, which had only been created as a united empire in 1871, suddenly Germany is beginning to stretch its kind of global muscles. They're building a world-class navy, and the thing that frightens the British more than anything else because the Britannia rules the waves. You know, they've got this huge global empire, and they've got the Royal Navy, the biggest navy in the world. I mean, they are the global superpower in the 19th century. And there are parallels could be drawn, between the Britain's sort of global reach in the late 19th century and the United States' global reach in the late 20th century. And the big growing challenge are the Germans, who start building this world-class navy. And the Brits are saying, well, what are they building this for? They've already got a world-class army, but that's fine. They can attack the Russians or the French. But the only people they're likely to take on or really challenge are the Brits. And they begin to worry about the potential of a German surprise attack, a kind of Pearl Harbor, what they called it at the time, a bolt from the blue, and that Germans might, suddenly launch an attack on Britain, a sort of a surprise invasion. And one of the very early modern and greatest of 20th century spy novels is a novel called The Riddle of the Sands, published in 1903, written by an Irishman, you see. So we're in there writing intelligence stuff from, there's a bit of a pedigree here. The Riddle of the Sands, the key to the plot is the discovery by two intrepid British yachtsmen of the Germans massing invasion barges in harbors on the North Sea coast, the German side of the North Sea, and this is, what they might do. So these fears are become a kind of public panic, and communicate themselves eventually, of course, to the government, who then say, right, well, we need to set up a systematic intelligence organization. One, to look for German spies in Britain, and that's the one that turns into MI5. The other, to look at German intentions and capabilities in Germany or on the continent, and that turns into MI6.
Mm. And that, it seems that all along that was extraordinarily difficult, particularly during the Second World War. It sounds as if it was next to impossible to get agents into Nazi Germany.
Yeah. I mean, the German security apparatus, the level of sort of paranoia and collective hysteria which the Gestapo, understandably, kind of develop, means that any stranger, anyone turning up, anyone doing something out of the ordinary comes under suspicion. I mean, these awful kinds of people reporting on their family and their neighbors and what have you. And at one stage, quite late in the war, it was calculated that the average life expectancy of an agent sent into Germany is 3 weeks. And there's not much you can do in that. So there's a lot of people sent in who don't last, and many of them perish, of course. So the actual, and again, this is one of these kind of contrasts with the movies and the novels, is that with a few notable exceptions, what you find in the real stories of the real James Bond is it's horrendously difficult to deal with. Some of the challenges faced in working in very, very hostile territory, not only just getting in there, but acquiring the intelligence and communicating the intelligence out again. So at each stage of these are immensely hazardous and, potentially fatal.
Yeah. What they did do, though, apparently the MI6 did have quite a bit of success, or a fair amount of success, providing support to resistance organizations in those countries that were occupied by the Nazis.
Yes, I mean, a lot of that, well, there are two aspects to this. One is supporting the actual resistance fighters, and that is more Special Operations Executive than MI6. But what MI6 do is they work with governments in exile who are then running and intelligence gathering agents in the resistance themselves. So these two sort of parallel developments. And sometimes, they challenge each other. So, for example, if you're wanting intelligence about railway movements. Railway movements are absolutely vital. I mean, it makes a huge difference in the autumn of 1940 or 1941 when the Germans have occupied Western Europe as whether the trains full of German troops are going west, potentially for an invasion of Britain, or they're going east, to Russia, or indeed southeast to the Balkans. And if you can gather this kind of information, lots of tiny bits of information about trains and what's on them and numbers of traffic, this is very good. Now, Special Operations take a different line to this. They say, well, we want to blow up railway junctions and viaducts and impede this. And, of course, as soon as they do that, the security is tightened up a lot in all these sort of sensitive areas. So you maybe your intelligence source then dries up because of the special operations. So there's a kind of balance to be struck between these different covert agencies. And there are turf wars and struggles between them, as you might expect.
Yeah, that apparently was particularly in the early years as these things were getting formed, that there was a lot of struggle between the SIS and other, and I'm sure with the country's regular military and you know various other entities within the British government that did military security kind of stuff.
Yes, that's right. I mean, and one of the difficulties that intelligence organizations have, both at the sort of bureaucratic government end and out in the field, is that they don't fit the normal military hierarchies. You get these fellas turning up at headquarters, you know, wearing a captain's uniform or a major's uniform, but apparently, you know, having a lot more kind of influence and access to things than maybe a general has. And this upsets, of course, the regular soldiers, because they don't like, you know, they like an orderly kind of world with the proper hierarchies. And these guys don't always fit into these models. And that produces, I mean, sort of personal and organizational difficulties. The trouble is, you know, once you formalize relationships and these guys, you tell the guys what you're doing, is that you reveal, you know, the secrets of your work, and that undermines your ability to do your job, you see. So there's always going to be a problem dealing with the regulars, if you like.
We have some other callers, and we'll get back to them. And the next person is in Tolono, and this is in on line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Mr. Jeffries, does your book deal with a person named Sidney Reilly? Now, he predated the MI6 formation, and he dealt mainly with Tsarist Russia and then later Bolshevik Russia.
Oh, yes. Ono Reilly, the so-called ace of spies, is a feature in the book. He is an MI6 agent. But though it's called MI1C at the time. I mean, the agency changes its name, and in fact, MI6 is just a sort of cover name. It's the Secret Intelligence Service. But Reilly turns up, yes, in the aftermath of the Bolshevik Revolution, offering his services to British intelligence. And the chief at the time, Cumming, takes him on, but he says he knows, he's been everywhere, he knows everything. He's a very suspicious kind of character, but I think we can use this guy. And Reilly, of course, has a series of covers. He's a master of kind of changing his name. He sounds Irish. He's not Irish at all. Nothing like it. And he is very successfully reporting, particularly out of southern Russia or southern Soviet Union in the early post-revolutionary days in 1919, and then takes on a kind of role saying that he'll be able to deal with the Bolshevik high command itself. He'd get to Moscow and get to St. Petersburg and deliver goods from there. And he gradually becomes more politicized. He sees it as his job to help bring down the Soviet Union. And that makes him less and less useful as a spy, because he's, he's so politically engaged and so desperate, desperately anti-Bolshevik, which is, of course, a good thing from the point of view of the, it fits the policies of the British government at the time. But because he's so politically charged, he begins to slacken off in his kind of eye to security. And in the end, he's lured back into the Soviet Union to his death, because he thinks he's dealing with reliable opposition groups. And in a way, what you want for a good spy, and a spy who might survive, is a man who's not actually too ideologically engaged with this, because that can lead you on to be over-ambitious and, over-confident in what you can do.
We have about 10-15 minutes left in this part of our show, Focus. Keith Jeffery is our guest. He's professor of British history at Queen's University Belfast and is the author of a recent book that's titled The Secret History of MI6. That is the Secret Intelligence Service, the British SIS, that was founded in 1909 and covers the period from 1909 to 1949, so just the very beginnings of the Cold War. Penguin Press is the publisher. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Another local caller here somewhere in Champaign-Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, interesting. Comment on the number of people and the budget for the Colossus computer that was used to decode Enigma messages in World War II. And also, the UK is very good at training people to speak modern foreign languages, but when did that start? Did they use language labs, you know, 10 hours a day listening to tape recordings? Because in 1940, the U.S. OSS people said they could not find Yanks who spoke modern foreign languages, and they needed them. Thanks.
Okay. Well, no, that's an absolutely essential requirement for a foreign language intelligence or a foreign intelligence service like SIS. And it's, again, one of those differences between the real James Bond and the fictional one. The real James Bond only appears to speak English. Or in Sean Connery's case, of course, Scottish. What they recruit, first of all, I mean, they're not actually teaching languages in the early days. What they draw on is there's a huge British commercial diaspora in the 19th century. You know, Britain is a very powerful commercial trading nation. And you find that the Brits are going across the world, in commercial jobs, but also building railroads, working in mines, setting up gas companies, all these sorts of things. So wherever you go, you'll find these pockets of expats who brought up their children speaking the local language like natives. There are certainly a lot of these in Russia at the time, a major trading partner for Britain. And you find that the people who are employed by the service as officers out in Russia and in the Scandinavia and the Baltic states tend to be drawn from this class of people who've, you know, second or third generation expats. Now, once the Second World War, and when you're sending agents in the Second World War, again, the same thing happens. And in fact, they begin looking for people to send into places like Germany and France and the Balkans in the United States and Canada from emigrant groups, who haven't been very long there. So the intensive language training, which certainly begins in the post-war years, isn't applied until certainly the 1940s. And you do get these intensive schools then set up at that stage with the language labs and all the rest. But in fact, it's drawing on the available expertise, looking for native speakers who might have left, who either are British expats over there or people who have emigrated out of countries that you're interested in Europe and sometimes Asia and come to bits of the English-speaking world, both British and indeed American.
And I guess the other question, and this is one that has been written about, one certainly could write an entire book about, have been written about the British efforts to break the German codes that they used, and then, of course, how that really was the beginning of research into computing that extends right to the present time. The caller was just maybe interested in what sort of resources went into that effort.
Well, I mean, the greatest imperial intelligence triumph for the British, certainly, and perhaps the Allies as a whole, in the Second World War, is the breaking of the German, and certainly in German Enigma enciphering machine. Now, that's a collective effort. There's assistance, certainly from the United States, although the United States are successful, too, in breaking the Japanese codes, which is very important. But the poor resources, both in terms of the practical backup, the Colossus, the first sort of modern computer, is a product of Bletchley Park, but also hiring, as it were, extremely clever people, mathematicians, people who can solve crosswords, you know, in 20 seconds kind of thing, people with several languages. And they gather together this extraordinary mixture of people from, you know, Oxford and Cambridge and anywhere where they can find super clever people and concentrate them at Bletchley. they combine this with, and one of the things that MI6 has overall control of the Bletchley Park, which is where the code breaking goes on. So they've a role to play in this. But they also provide liaison support from the French and the Poles, who have done a lot of work on this, and what MI6 can bring to the British effort for the code breaking is the assistance of Allied services as well. And in 1940 and early 41, American cryptanalysis cryptographers are brought into Bletchley Park. This is again before America's in the war. And again, this is part of the, as it were, charm offensive, if you like, of trying to bring the Americans into the war. But they bring them to Bletchley Park and they say, actually, we will tell you the greatest secret of the war, the greatest intelligence secret. And this is before their allies. So it's an extraordinary moment. But they, while they're doing this, they say, well, we must, we can tell them this, but for goodness sake, I slightly paraphrase the minute, but for goodness sake, don't let them know we've been reading their diplomatic correspondence for the past 20 years, which is what the British Signals Intelligence Agency, which is very, very good in the interwar period, have been reading all the American diplomatic. So the British have been spying sort of regularly on the Americans. This is part of this extraordinary story of both, you know, America as a target and as an ally, as it shifts into the Second World War, into that extraordinary alliance, which was so important and so productive for winning the war against fascism.
I just have a couple minutes left. We have some other callers, and we can't get everybody, but I want to try to maybe do at least one more. We'll do a Cumberland County here. This is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is also about the World War II era. Mm-hmm. And what was the British intelligence role in keeping Franco from entering the war, if there was one? And also, was there a British intelligence connection with Admiral Canaris? Was Canaris an actual British spy, if you will?
Well, the second one is easy to answer. Canaris is not a British spy, but Canaris, who ends up on the German opposition side, you know, the internal opposition to Hitler, is apparently not unsympathetic to some contacts. And there is a moment in during the middle of the Second World War when a Polish woman working for British intelligence has dinner with Canaris and reports back that night, and I have the very signal in the book, reports back in October 1941, after having dinner, as I say, with Canaris. And this is after the German invasion of Russia. And one of the things Canaris says, well, he thinks that Hitler may have bitten off more than he can chew, and this is not going to end well. Now, you know, that was happy news and, of course, accurate news coming through. But you have this sort of hot report, as I say, from a spy for MI6 is the only known moment at which that's as close as I think Canaris gets to being a British agent. No, he wasn't. As for Franco, yes, there was a big covert operation, partly run by MI6, partly run by the embassy, partly run by SOE, to keep Spain neutral. Huge amounts of money are sent as a sort of kind of, well, I mean, not to put too fine a point to it, to bribe Spanish opinion formers to stay on side on this. Now, in fact, Franco realizes that coming into the war on the German side might be more difficult than not. So, in fact, you're pressing at a kind of open door with this one. But you get a huge amount of activity between, of course, German intelligence, which is very well supported in France, or not in France, in Spain, in Franco's Spain, and of course neutral Portugal as well. And there's a, you know, there's a long kind of narrative of what's going on in Spain. There, it's a lot of it's a very interesting story indeed, and very important.
And there's so much here, and we're sort of coming down to just having a couple of minutes. There's so much here, so many great stories. Many wonderful little details, and if I could be forgiven for bringing up James Bond again, there's just one thing that just tickled me so much. People, I'm sure, will recall in the movie Goldfinger, where James Bond comes up to a beach swimming out of the water. He's wearing a wetsuit. He takes off his wetsuit, and he's wearing a tuxedo underneath. Well, apparently, somebody actually did that.
That's right. A Dutchman called Hazelaar They want to put him ashore on the beach at a place called Scheveningen, where there's a casino. And in those good old days, with a proper decent dress, you know, formal dress, people would wear tuxedos to go to the casino at night. And they wanted to get this guy on shore, and he could immediately mingle with the crowds. So they provide him with his tuxedo. They put him in a rubber waterproof suit. They sprinkle brandy over him so that he can appear to be a little bit the worse for wear. They land him on the beach. He goes up, and it works, and indeed he survives the war to tell the tale.
Mm. It's a great story. We're real short on time, but we will try to get one more caller here. This is Effingham, line 4. Hello.
One question. The moral imperative of this conversation and your book and colonialism, and it was all inevitable. Would you agree with that?
And colonial...
Colonialism.
Well, I mean, the British Empire.
Yes, colonialism.
You know, is the most powerful single power system in the world. And this organization was set up to help protect it. So it certainly plays its part in that, though the intelligence within the empire is all seen as domestic and, in fact, is down to MI5. So what Six is doing is protecting it, for example, against Bolshevik subversion, which is heavily anti-colonial at the time. But, yes, for the British power system as it existed, which is imperial and colonial, yes, MI6 is part of that. Yeah.
Mm. I don't know if we have just literally about a minute or so left. I don't know if there's any last particular story that you might like to tell or a particular person that you might want to talk about.
Well, back to the real James Bond, there is a guy called Biffy Dunderdale, improbably named, who was a pal of Ian Fleming's, and he was one of these guys. He was brought up in Odessa, British engineering family, spoke fluent Russian, ends up speaks fluent French as well, is head of station in Paris, likes pretty women, fast cars, very important sort of dashing man. And in his old age, he used to say he read stories in some of the Fleming's novels that seemed to be stories he told Ian Fleming. And so we have a picture of him in the book. You can make up your own mind whether you think he fits the model or not.
Yeah, I'm glad we got around to Biff Dunderdale. That sounds to me like somebody out of P.G. Woodhouse somehow. But and he apparently was a friend of Fleming. It's interesting, I guess, that some of the spy fiction that we like so much was in fact written by people who did work in those agencies, and you have to be sure that as they went along, various little things that they saw that happened, people that they knew, and ended up getting incorporated in the stories that they wrote.
Exactly. And Fleming worked in naval intelligence, and he knew a lot of what was going on in the war, and it's certainly some of that comes through in the novels, if in a kind of glamorized and sort of technicolor version of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And well, it's also true that so many of the principal actors here are men. There were indeed some women who did intelligence gathering work as well.
I haven't begun to talk about the women, very brave women in occupied Belgium in the First World War, just ordinary people doing extraordinary things, or a double agent, Agent Ecclesiastic, who is the lover of the head of German intelligence in Lisbon in 1944 and 45, and she is run by Peter Ustinov's father, a man called Klop Ustinov, and he fancied her terribly. You can see in his reports that he clearly wanted to get into bed with her, though I don't think she did. She was fully occupied in the German intelligence bed, as it were, but providing essential sort of disinformation material for that. You know, there is a whole further narrative to be told about the important role that women play in intelligence during these years.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. There's certainly a lot in this book. It is a big book and has many good stories here about this 40-year period that we're talking about between 1909, when SIS was established, and in 1949. And this book, The Secret History of MI6, by our guest Keith Jeffrey, who is a professor of British history at Queen's University, Belfast, the first person ever really to be given access to this archive. So he had the opportunity to go through it and read this book. Is it now closed again? Will there nobody else be given the same access that you got?
There are no plans in the foreseeable future to let anybody else in. So you're going to have to wait. And all you've got is my book, which I hope is enough to keep you going for the meantime.
All right. And the book here is published in the U.S. by Penguin Press. Professor Jeffrey, thanks very much for talking with us.
It's been a privilege and a pleasure. Thank you.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming baseball legend Dave Winfield and the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra as they present The Baseball Music Project on Friday, November 12th at 7:30 p.m. More information is available at krannertcenter.com. Support comes from Urbana's Market at the Square, Saturdays through November 6th at the corner of Illinois and Vine in downtown Urbana. Then on November 13th, the Urbana Business Association's Holiday Market begins inside Lincoln Square Mall. Details online at urbanaillinois.us/market or urbanabusiness.com.
And that's it for us on Focus. Up next is the Afternoon Magazine, the host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. It is 1 minute before noon. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana. Let's take a look at commodity prices now. In Kansas City, December wheat, that contract is trading at $7.65.5, up 11 and a half. March, 782 and a quarter, up 12 and three quarters. In Chicago, December wheat, 716 and a quarter, up 13 and a half. March, 756, up 14 and a half. December corn, 579 and a quarter, up two. March, 592, up one and three quarters. May, 597 and three quarters, up one and three quarters. July, 601 and a quarter, up one and a half. November soybeans, 1228 and three quarters, up five. January, 1240 and a quarter, up four and a quarter. March, 1245, up three. May, 1244 and a quarter, up two. July, 1248, up two and three quarters. December meal, 338.10, up 220. December oil, 49.70, up 10. October live cattle, $100.10. That's down 40. December, 99 even, down 1.